Sam Hamill's the author of 14 volumes of original poetry, has published 3 collections of essays and 24 volumes translated from ancient Greek, Latin, Estonian, Japanese, and Chinese. The founding editor of Copper Canyon Press and the director of Poets Against War, his work has been translated into more than a dozen languages, and the latest book is Measured by Stone. Sam just gave a reading at Doe Bay last night, and basically read from this and new work, the Habitation series, which has not yet been published. I mean, not yet been published in a book form.
In trade form.
In trade form.
If you've got a spare 10,000 lying around, I got a book for you.
Yeah. Have you ever? I don't think you've ever told that story about Ian Boyden. You told it last night. And we recorded the reading last night, so people can refer to the recording. But maybe you could talk a little bit about meeting Ian Boyden and what he did with your work.
Well, I discovered his work at an AWP book fest in Vancouver, B.C. And his wife told me that my work as poet, translator, printer had been one of his inspirations. And he's a studio artist, a painter, scholar of Chinese, and a remarkable artist bookmaker. And I wrote the first of the trilogy called Habitations. It's basically an ekphrastic poem honoring his unique process of using things like fossilized ear bone of whale ground up into the inks that he makes. Well, I was totally blown away by his work, and we met, and he sent me some catalog things, and I looked at some of his images, and I dedicated the first of the Habitations trilogy to him, which I thought was just going to be one poem. But I realized by the end of it that there had to be a couple of follow-up sections. So it's a trilogy that I dedicated to him because his work is so profound and so inspirational.
Crab Quill Press.
Crab Quill Press.
So you realize that this it didn't end after the first series of poems. Tell us a little bit about that impulse that you recognize there's more to it here.
Well, sometimes you write something and you think, you know, I got it. And then you come back to it a week later and you realize, well, you know, this isn't really the end. This is a pause, but I have more to say in this way and in this style and in this voice. And if you're listening carefully to that voice, you follow your voice. I mean, you have to bow to your muse.
This gets to a question I had been meaning to ask you for a while and get on tape about the difference between the epic tradition, which, I don't know, we associate with Europe and America, and the serial tradition, which we associate more with a West Coast kind of sensibility, and what Robin Blazer and Robert Duncan and Jack Spicer talked about. So can you talk about the serial tradition and maybe how that's more of a West Coast thing than an East Coast or Midwest thing?
Well, it seems to be more prominent among a certain group of West Coast poets. The poem in sequence can be inspired in various ways. One of them is simply through lyrical form, which provides a kind of syntax which one begins to follow. And one returns to that music, to that language, with a certain ability to listen within yourself and extend that rhythm, extend that kind of speech, extend the meditation, but not in a narrative way, which is necessary for the epic. The epic has to have a narrative base. And while there may be narrative impulses and shadows in the serial poem or the sequential poem, its root is not a narrative poem. Its root is shorter and more lyrical.
If there's a narrative thread, it's often one that develops organically and maybe outside the awareness of the poet writing.
Yeah.
And Habitations has some of those elements of the serial poem, especially when we look at how you end with a phrase and then repeat with that phrase or something similar.
Well, I don't exactly repeat the phrase. I inexactly repeat the phrase, as Marvin Bell would say. You have to be careful about that sort of thing, or it can become simply a device. So Finding the Measure. Robert Kelly has a wonderful poem by that title, Finding the Measure. Is finding the mantram. Is finding how to proceed. And it's inspirational. I mean, you have to listen to your muse. And the more you force things syntactically, the further away you tend to get from the truth of the poem, as it were.
And when it's used as a device, maybe you could speak a little bit to the dangers of that, or what that reflects when something is being used as a device.
Well, that issue is the matter of artifice. Artifice can make a poem, and it can also destroy a poem. I think of that line from that wonderful George Seferis poem that I read last night, our art whose features have been eaten away by gold. We've loaded our poetry with so much music that it is slowly sinking. This idea that you can overload a work of art. So you don't want to load up. And each of us has a slightly different impulse. And it's being true to the impulse and being true to whatever your literary values, whatever your philosophical values are. In my case, in the poem Habitations, I was trying to connect in a very deep way with the ecology of the Northwest. And in each of the poems, there's a list of extinct animals and plants and things. Thinking about those things that have gone extinct, except that they are still within us. They're within us within the imagination, but they're also biologically within us. So it's organic poetry that's actually organic.
Well, it's interesting. I'm reminded of the indigenous people who say that, some scientists came and checked the genetics of a cedar tree and found bear or found salmon genes in it, because the bears eat the salmon, the bears shit the salmon, and the salmon genes become part of that tree.
Yeah.
Literally part
yeah.
of the tree. Yeah. So that's what you're getting at.
Yeah.
What about the research to find these different extinct species? How was that?
Well, that's abundantly available. There's plenty of information online in any library about animal and plant and insect extinction. And I had read a lot about it over the many years. So I didn't really have to look much up. I mean, I did look up a few things. But mostly the things I mention are things that I've at one time or another studied. For instance, the Western camel. When you think about camels roaming Puget Sound, it sort of boggles the mind, There were camels here.
Isn't that the fear of the average right-wing American? Camels will return and we'll have
I think it's the camel herders that they worry about.
The camel jockeys. Right. There are some great images. I mean, just even saying the names and hearing them aloud, there's some great images of that. And they you talk about the Fenopoeia, just beautiful images that kind of gallop across your mind's eye when you hear that poem.
Yeah.
So when I think of...
Well, there's also a kind of Zen thusness in that. There's a really wonderful Zen koan that says, why is the white horse not a horse? So it's ways to pique the imagination and to try to engage the imagination and philosophy and history all at once.
And an ethos of responsibility.
Yeah, and an ethos, of course.
Of the human... not being anthropocentric, but taking their rightful place in the great order of things.
Yes.
Yeah. So to get back to that serial versus epic, I'm trying to get a sense of, how the West Coast has, and the Pacific Rim for that matter, the Rexroth quote from the Morris Graves essay about how we on the West Coast owe more to Asian traditions than we do to European traditions. And this notion of the serial poem as opposed to the epic, I think, is an important distinction. You know, with the epic, we've got the sense of the European and thus the American, you know, hero, the white knight coming to the rescue, whether it's John Wayne or the, you know, the Knights of the Round Table or whoever. But we on the West Coast maybe don't buy into that as readily. Do you agree with that?
Well, I think literarily, I mean, in terms of pop culture, we certainly do buy into it. But in speaking of the literary community, I think there's a great deal of skepticism about that sort of thing. And that skepticism really arose with people like Robinson Jeffers. Jeffers was the first West Coast poet. And we owe a great deal to Jeffers, including his severe questioning of Western cultural traditions. So that's sort of built into us as West Coast poets. But also, this is newer land than the East Coast. We white invaders. And we rub shoulders with Native Americans constantly. Whereas in New York City and Boston, not so much.
You know? Front of the cigar store, maybe.
So we're open to that, that deeper sense of what we would call biodiversity, both among humans and non-human species. Linguistically, I would bet that most sort of white, East Coast-type literary people, their second language is French. I mean, not all of them. I mean, there's some, you know, Italian speakers and German speakers and etc. But French is sort of the dominant literary language. And it was French that really gave us our American poetry. The big influences on Pound and Williams and the people who came after Pound and Williams were French. So you can say that American poetry has been hugely shaped by the French poets.
Rimbaud, Mallarmé, people like that.
Sure. But on the West Coast, beginning with people like Gary Snyder especially, but even before Snyder, you think of people like, what's his name, the Chinese translator from Arizona, Winter Binner. Guys like Winter Binner and those anthologies of Chinese poems had an enormous effect on American poetry across the board. I once wrote an essay claiming that Pound's Cathay was the most influential book of the 20th century. It's just 14 poems and 14 short poems by Lee Bow. And yet, that really brought that personal short lyric poem into American poetry. It didn't exist that way before. On the West Coast, we had the beginnings of a Zen Buddhist practice in America. And we had poets like Gary Snyder, Phil White, and Kenneth Rexroth, who studied seriously Asian cultures and languages. And that had a huge impact on all of us. Much more than learning to speak French, for instance. If you're not a real student of Chinese or Japanese here, chances are your second language is Spanish. And there's a much bigger Spanish population that's not Puerto Rican. I don't mean to exclude Puerto Ricans from anything. It's just that so many Puerto Ricans moved to places like New York City. They created islands of basically Puerto Rican culture, which is fine. I'm not being critical. I'm just pointing out that in the West, we had migrant workers, we had indigenous peoples. All of these things were there around us all the time, and we were aware of them. So it's really a different sensibility between the West Coast and the East Coast.
In fact, if you look at the mission of San Juan Capistrano, it goes back to 1776, which when you think about it, on the East Coast, they were starting a country. On the West Coast, it was a Spanish colony at that time. Yeah, Jeffers, you know, was trained in the classics, spoke Latin and Greek, and yet, and so in a way, he's this pinnacle of Western philosophy who came to the edge of the continent and said, basically, it dies here, is basically his conclusion. And then he comes up with this notion of inhumanism, which is sort of a crude attempt to suggest that we need to recognize our true place in the scheme of things.
Yeah,
which has very...
It was his objection to living in an anthropomorphic universe. or an anthropocentric universe.
Right. What are some of the other characteristics of a West Coast and Pacific Rim poetics?
Open space in our poems. Poems about mountain ranges, poems about deserts, poems about prairies, poems about living among animals. These were the norm to us. You know, the East Coast idea of nature is thorough. Who, you know, on most nights walk for 20 minutes over to Emerson's house to get dinner, while, you know, proclaiming his, you know, love of, quote, nature, unquote, and saying that he could be happy living in an ammo box, which is absurd. But it takes a Hayden Carruth 100 years later to point out the absurdity of such an idea. Whereas so many of us in the West, we grew up around cattle ranches and sheep ranches, and there were mountains to climb and places to wander, a lot of wandering in West Coast poetry.
And you learn how you...
On the other hand, it took a very long while for us to develop any kind of urban poetry at all. I mean, if you look at much of West Coast poetry, where does our urban voice begin to arise? You know, well, sometimes maybe in Rexroth, but, you know, maybe Retke? I don't know. Whereas the urban voice is a constant in East Coast poetry. If they have a different kind of richness, I'm not, you know, making this an either or. I'm just pointing out a difference.
Yeah, you're making the distinction. Right,
yeah.
Exactly. And it's almost the sense that this is it's a very young literary culture still.
Oh, yeah.
In one way, it's a deficit because it's not mature. But in the other way, it's here, ours, for the shaping.
Well, and in some ways, it's a deeply mature tradition because of our tendency to be more involved in what we would call deep ecology or deep anthropology. When I was a child, for instance, understanding a little bit about Navajo and Hopi culture was just profound as all hell. And that's something you wouldn't likely get going to school in, you know, like Virginia. I mean, you might learn about the five civilized tribes, but you learn about them in a kind of remote way. Whereas here, I had friends who were Navajo and Hopi. And, you know, going to a sweat the first time, that's a kind of Western, Southwestern experience that's really bound up in a sense of place and a sense of pre-American white male domination. And you begin to see that on the real, you know, this once pointed out to me, if you do a line a mile long, the last 1 inch of that line would cover all of the history of humanity. And the beginning of that line is the beginning of planet Earth. So it tells you what a very tiny little bit of history we as human beings actually occupy.
It's a flash.
And when you look at it that way, you can understand why somebody like Pound or Rexroth would insist that genius is always contemporary. And that Sophocles is as contemporary today as he ever was. You simply have to have eyes and ears to see and hear.
The West Coast Beat Movement interest in Buddhist culture, that's had an effect on the culture period, hasn't it?
It's when?
It's had an effect on the culture period.
Oh, of course it has. Of course it has. You know, without the beat scene in the 50s, there wouldn't have been any hippies. The hippies were just sort of the popularization of some aspects of the crazier edges of the beat movement. Anytime you have a movement, there's always a lunatic fringe. And there are always more movement followers than movement makers. And followers are, whatever else they are, followers. So Rexroth, Duncan, Snyder, etc., they created a spark that started a fire, part of which burned out of control. If you look at the beat writers, there were all of these fringe people. There were really only five or six of them who are actually really remarkable writers. And there were all of these sort of fringe types who were, you know, became a cliche. You know, women wearing black leotards and hanging out late at night in smoky jazz clubs. And the romance of all of that.
And the guy with the beret and the bongos.
Sure, sure.
Dobie Gillis kind
of. Sure, and the you know, curiously studious
yeah.
Hipness to be hip. You simply had to be hip. That was essential. I mean, that's largely a waste of time being hip.
You're hip, aren't you?
That's very hip.
I'm going back.
I wasn't just hip, I was cool.
Which begs the question that Tower Power asks, what is hip? Eyes wide open. You mentioned the story about the American Friends Service Committee and their, I was going to call it an exhibit, but it was more of a...
It was an exhibit.
An exhibit,
yeah.
of these thousands of pairs of empty boots, suggesting this is part of the loss of the Iraq War. You've got a quote in there, empty saddles in the old corral, where do they ride tonight? And this was, the line before it says, when I was a child, frightened of the night and crying in my bed, my father told me a poem or sang. He sang this. Can you tell a little bit about that story?
Empty saddles in the old corral, where do they ride tonight?
You didn't sing it last night.
It was a 1930s cowboy song.
Yeah.
You know, sloppy, silly, romantic, but kind of charming in a hokey way. And, of course, when you're a kid, wow, you know. I grew up on a horse. I was, we'll use my boot as a begging bowl for an ice drink. I grew up in a cowboy culture. And I apparently was a pretty badly abused infant. And I had the night terrors. So, going to bed was a really scary time for me because I didn't know whether I was going to have nightmares or, you know, whether I would actually sleep. And him reciting poems or reading poems or singing some of these cowboy songs would really calm me down. And I'd have him sing it again, and the second time through I'd start falling asleep, and maybe the third time through it I would drift off into sleep.
Yeah. This was your adopted family.
Yeah.
And this was in Utah.
Yeah.
Born in Northern California, but raised in Utah.
Yeah.
Till you ran away at about age, what, 13, 14?
14.
14 years old.
Yeah.
And you ran from there to San Francisco?
Yeah.
And it was Rex.
I got busted in Reno, sent back, stayed a couple of months, ran away again at 15, and that was when I pretty much stayed away until I went back and tried to spend a little bit of time in high school. Because Kenneth had convinced me that, you know, you got to have an education.
Kenneth Rexroth.
However you're going to get it, you got to get it.
Yeah.
And, you know, I was doing some pretty bad shit on the streets in San Francisco. So I went back to take a shot at high school. You can imagine trying to go to a high school in Holiday, Utah, after having spent most of a year hanging out with, you know, people like Kenneth Rexroth. So that wasn't working out. So I knew I needed some discipline, so I enlisted in the Marine Corps for a ticket out of there.
At age?
17.
At 17.
Yeah.
And that was legal at the time?
Yeah.
Don't give them any ideas, huh? You might start that program up again. Back on page 17 of Measured by Stone, you were right, of course, the struggle for poetry in the world cannot take place in a museum. And that line's in quotes, the struggle for poetry.
There are poets that produce what I call a museum of ideas. And I'm not going to name names because that's sort of pointless. It's distracting. Because what I'm talking about is the idea of being alive in a living language and trying to find the truth of the essential experience of this or that or the other. Being receptive to the change that is constant within all of us. My theory about fixed forms is that they tend to invite people to think in fixed ideas, which is why you have so many fixed meters. Whereas in actual life, it doesn't come at you that way. It's in bits and pieces and starts and jumps and leaps and sometimes flowing very smoothly like a river, sometimes blowing apart like a tire. So this sort of museum of ideas is like, for instance, romantic poetry. I mean, to most of us these days, an actual romantic poem sounds pretty bad, you know. It's got end rhyme, it's probably in pentameter, and, you know, you're sort of talking about your emotions rather than actually having any emotions or actually stirring any emotions. For me, the function of the poem is to sort of tell its tale, but to do it with an emotional base that is felt as well as reasoned.
Zhukovsky's quote comes to mind, and he said, only emotion objectified endures.
Well, yeah.
The next thing is on that same page, in that same poem, we're talking about the poem Arguing with Milošin Vilnius. And you say here, the poem, a record of survival. Why don't you flesh that out a little bit?
Well, in the context of Miwash, of course, he's a World War II exile who, you know, took up home in France, from which he basically exiled himself to the United States. I'm an orphan. That makes me a permanent exile. I'm an atheist in a basically religious country. Another kind of exile, philosophical exile, existentialism. And simply being a poet in a culture like this creates a kind of exile. Because we're uncommon. I mean, we're very uncommon people. With uncommon likes and dislikes and passions. So, you know, it's not a big stretch.
So the poem written by you or someone like you is as a record of survival. This is the daily task of trying to exist in a culture that doesn't appreciate poetry.
Well, trying to live reasonably in an irrational culture.
You say that being a poet in this culture is rare, but yet we've had in the last 20 years an explosion of MFA programs and creative writing programs, and as a result, an explosion of poets. You said last night, everybody's a poet and everybody's an editor.
Well, in a way, that's true. And I think that's altogether basically a good thing. We've created a kind of target audience for poetry, and I think that's a little bit dangerous. And we've also created a kind of business class of poets. And I think this is what people really object to when they badmouth the MFA programs. The way it gets into turned into a little corner of academia. It'd be much better for our culture if a lot of those people would get out of academia and come and live in the real world, as it were. It'd be nice if I wasn't, you know, the only regularly publishing poet in Anacortes, which I guess I am. I don't know of another one. Because I know there are people here who write poetry. You can find them on among the 30,000 poems at Poets Against War. And it's the way, you know, there are millions of painters as well, but how many really serious painters are there at any given point? Well, there's quite a few, but they're not in the thousands, you know, maybe in the hundreds.
So the danger in this business class category for poets is that they run the risk of creating this kind of elitism that's separate from people that...
I'm not opposed to elitism, you know. when people use that word in the pejorative, I just think, you know, I spent a lot of years trying to get a grip on classical Chinese and Japanese poetry and philosophy. And the people who have translated that stuff with any degree of success, that's a very small club. And I'm happy to be a member of that club. You want to kill this for a second? And let her
sure.
out.
I'll just let it go and I'll just edit when we get back.
She probably needs to go pee. Do you need to get out, babe? Before she started peeing.
Did you leave the door closed? You're going to be out for a while? Did you leave it open or closed?
I left it open, so I shouldn't get back in.
Talking with Sam Hamill, the author of Measured by Stone on Curbstone Press, founding editor of Copper Canyon Press, and the director of Poets Against War. So what is the danger, then, of the business class of poets, the MFA grad?
Well, what happens is people with a problem with their ego build little creeks and cliques and turfs and neighborhoods, and they become the little lords of their little neighborhood. And, you know, a little humility before the task is a good idea. And when you build followers, you don't build leaders. I mean, followers aren't leaders. And poets need to be leaders of their language and leaders of their art.
It's very interesting that the planned next question I had to do with the section of your book that's entitled Lessons from Thieves. Now, I didn't need to make that intentional a segue, but that's where I was going with that before you went into that last bit about, you know, the ego building of the business class of poets, to use your words about it. But also here, we had an interesting conversation on the ferry coming back from Dobe, talking about the basic teachings of Confucius. And so maybe you can weave the last thread about the business class into how it stands in opposed to that Confucian basic teaching. I mean, if we go back to Confucius and the way he explained it on the ferry...
The great learning,
we're very... We see where this business class begins to be part of the danger of that by building
sure.
the ego. So even
well, the Neo-Confucians were a perfect example of how you corrupt the fundamentally wonderful teachings of Confucius, and you create an enormous bureaucracy within which everyone is struggling for their own turf. The same thing happens in the poetry community when you get into the business of it. You know, who gets the paycheck? Who gets to give the reading? Who gets to be the master teacher? And people who are master teachers for a livelihood and who do this constantly, I mean, what a weird perspective on the world. Day in and day out, you're talking to this little handful of people who are your admirers. I mean, it's very difficult, I would think, for someone like that to keep their head above the water.
When you have acolytes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And sycophants.
And sycophants, yeah. So the there's a line in Testament of the Thief. I never cause a disturbance, no too loud laughter, no angry glance. Is there an anecdote that goes with that, no too loud laughter?
Well, you know, one of the knocks on me is I'm too intense. And I have a very famous, very loud laugh. And I've been criticized for that by certain kinds of people. So I'm just thumbing my nose at them.
My neighbor at the new Splab said, I knew things were going well because I could hear your laugh through the walls. And so I'm thinking, okay, no too loud laughter, very good. I'm not in the thief category when it comes to that. But the ability to have that kind of laugh is what you're getting at. The ability to be so open and vulnerable that you can have that kind of laugh.
Well, and in my case, I'm deaf, and that makes a lot of me loud. I mean, you know, we deaf people, we don't know how loud our voice is. We really can't tell. And we tend to be loud because we don't hear ourselves, you know.
Yeah. There's also another...
But I was loud before I was deaf, so, you know. I'm just kind of a boisterous kind of guy sometimes, and sometimes I'm very quiet.
And your intensity?
Well, what about it?
Where do you think that comes from, and why is it so feared in this culture?
Well, first of all, I paid certain kinds of prices for the way I've conducted my life. I spent many years in a kind of voluntary poverty. I was nearly 20 years at Copper Canyon Press before I started getting a paycheck. I taught in prisons, and I learned to really love those men. And even though some of them did really horrible things, I saw how the system screws over them. But yet, as I used to tell my students there, they can keep you behind bars, but they can't imprison your imagination. And your imagination is where you really live anyway, whether you're in jail or not. So it's really about what you do with your imagination. And I have an idea about spending my life in the service of something larger than myself, or something larger than the consumption of goods. And that was to be in the service of poetry. A lot of people don't understand what that entails. And they see my attitude and my frankness as threatening. But that, frankly, is more their problem than my problem. I don't threaten anyone. I'm devoted to nonviolence. But I'm also devoted to appreciating a non-materialist culture and to creating a non-materialist culture. And I'm a socialist who lives in a capitalist state, which means that I'm confronted every day by the profound immoralism of my own country.
And a culture which fears someone like you who dedicates their life to something non-material.
Yeah, yeah.
Which, I mean, that goes...
It's repressive.
Goes to the core of the how you left Copper Canyon Press.
Yeah, yeah.
Something wrong with a culture that allows something like that to happen.
Well, of course there is. But it happens all the time. You know, what they did to me was what George Bush did to Iraq. They built up a straw man and said, he's threatening, and let's get him.
Right. What?
So, me and Saddam, you know?
So the people who listen to this in retrospect, who were all hoping that the election of November 2, 2010 didn't turn out the way it's likely to turn out, they wonder, what happens to these guys who set up the straw men? Where is the justice? Can we take solace in the fact that anytime there's hubris involved, the person's going to go down, or is there more to it than that?
No, there's no reason why we should expect justice in a system that's built the way our system is built. As long as they're going to engage in the politics of personal destruction, as Karl Rove called it, then anything is fair game. Rumor, innuendo, blasphemy, lies, deceits, double dealings, it's all business. And American business people do this all the damn time.
And if you've got money, you can do it.
Yeah, sure.
That justifies
sure.
it. Bill Ransom said a very interesting thing. You know, I told him that in Auburn, I was, you look at a typical South or Central American country and there's a coup d'etat, and what's the first thing that happens? They take over the radio station one, they shoot the poets two. What am I doing in Auburn? I'm doing radio and poetry, right?
Well.
And Bill said, but in this country, they don't assassinate you, they assassinate your character.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, spot on.
Yeah. Page 47, the poem is the Nine Gates series, which is a really beautiful poem. I didn't read that last night, and it's...
It's nine poems long,
right.
And each one of those poems is a meditation and should be meditated on.
Still would be here tonight. It would be nice to hear it read sometime. Anyway... The last bit of this whole poem, well, the last bit of number eight, I guess it is, yeah, is guy standing by me at a Levertov reading 20 years ago, whispers in my ear, she reads just like she talks, except her voice seems to come from somewhere else. So it's a great anecdote. And, you know, to me, it also goes to what she and Robert Duncan were talking about in the early 60s in their correspondence about organic poetry. And that goes to Robin Blazer's essay, The Practice of Outside, this notion that the source of the poem is outside of us. Even if it's in a truss of the language to go where it needs to go, there's this kind of sublimation to something bigger, in this case, the process. And with her, not just with the writing, but with the actual reading of it. In public.
Oh, yeah, yeah, sure.
Tell us about it.
I mean, all of us who are real poets, when we read the poem, there's a different quality in the voice, even though the tone of the voice and the words are the same tone and words. And it's what the poetry itself does with the voice. I mean, it's the music of the mind moving among the 10,000 things. Also from this same sequence, before poetry was called poetry, what was its name? Before truth was a word, there was still truth, and it had a name. Sher Shuang, writing long ago, thought words were expedient means. Buddhas are born of necessity. Sher Shuang himself must have groped along. So words are expedient means, but they're not the result. They're not a consequence. They're not an arrival. They're a means.
An approximation.
And words evolve and change, and meanings change. Yeah. A poem is, in its own way, a provisional conclusion.
Provisional.
Provisional.
It's the best you can achieve in the moment.
Yeah.
How does Denise fit into the grand scheme? When the history of West Coast or Pacific Rim poetics is written, how does Denise fit in?
Elusively. First of all, she's not a West Coaster. I once criticized her for too many inversions in a poem. And she laughed at me and she said, you just don't understand. I have a mid-Atlantic accent. You know, she was born and raised in England and came to America and spent most of her life living in Boston and Maine and New York. And then moved late in her life to Seattle. But her poetics, as her huge correspondence with Robert Duncan makes abundantly clear, is primary philosophical material for West Coast poetry. And she was, you know, a projective verse poet, an organic poet. Her essays on organic poet, both of them are absolutely wonderful.
Some notes on organic form,
yeah,
and the function of the line, those two specifically.
Yeah.
You've already done your spiel on line breaks, so people can probably refer to that because you've done it enough. But too many poets are writing, you know, mediocre prose broken up into line breaks. And if you can have that clever kind of end, that's their notion, the typical notion of line breaks. But it's a lot deeper than that.
One of the dangers of workshopping is that you learn to rely on things like wit. If you can make something witty and you'll get a kind of immediate response. But it's only immediate, and in a way it's a kind of low-grade response. It's kind of a cheap response. I said of the nine gates that they were meditations and they needed to be meditated on, and that's why I didn't read them. I mean that in a very serious way. Workshops tend to produce groupthink, and we tend to start writing like one another because we're getting together, you know, twice a week or once a week and spending hours going over our poems. And I mean, there's some good in that back and forthness of it. But there's also this risk of groupthink and of relying simply on a poetry of wit and not thinking carefully about the process of being a poet. And that is, you know, how do you find and follow what's given? And poetry is, after all, above all else, it's a gift. It's a gift to the poet from the muse, that thing we call inspiration, which the poet, in the act of being a poet, a maker, transforms in order to give it away so that someone can hear the poem, read the poem, feel the poem, and want to respond to that poem by saying, oh, I can't wait to give this away. So it really is a condition of gift economics. But it's a gift that also comes with a certain responsibility. And if your primary goal is to be popular, workshops are a really good thing because you find out what works in the workshop. But if your design is not simply to be popular, but to really deeply engage a tradition, then that workshop is a distraction more than anything else, because it's drawing you away from the tradition that you should be excavating, like an archaeologist. You should be studying these stones instead of wetting your finger and seeing which way the wind blows.
Like Olson calling one of his books Archaeologist of Morning.
Yeah, yeah.
And you...
Well, as you know, he was a very good amateur archaeologist.
Yeah, going to the digging into the Mayan culture was part of that, yeah. So when we get into that groupthink, we're also conditioning ourselves not to recognize the peculiar gifts that the muse has for us as individuals and unable to really achieve our deepest gesture as an individual in that way. That's part of what you're saying, right?
Yeah, yeah.
All right. There's a story you've told before, and in this latest iteration of this, or maybe this is the first time you've said it in poetry, I'm not sure. I've heard you tell the story before. A Word in Farsi is the poem on page 51. From the Chinese Xi, poetry is the word for word, married to the word for temple. The temple, or a pictograph of the hand reaching down, cradling a seedling. So you tell the story here that also goes to the old logo of that company you used to work for. So maybe you can, that itself is also a rough translation of what the Chinese word for poet or pictograph for poetry really means.
Yeah. Yeah.
What is it exactly? I mean, if you can make it literal. You've told me this before, the temple of word, the sound of...
Well, poetry is a temple of words. A temple made of words.
And the literal translation in English would be...
Poetry.
Not the sound of the man's, the mouth of the man who cradles the seed or something like that?
I don't know what you're remembering, but...
Well, where's the seed? The hand is reaching down, cradling a seedling. So how does that...
Well, there's a hook on the bottom of this character. And what that hook represents is the hand reaching down with the seedling in it. That is about to plant the seed. So that poetry is where seeds get planted. Or poetry is a planting of seeds, you might say. But you can also say that poetry is a temple. That's a wonderful thing about Chinese etymology. You can get hooked on this shit like Ezra Pound did and get completely off track. But that particular character, I think, is quite wonderful. The character for word combined with the character for temple to get poetry.
Well, one last main subject here. One of the later poems in the book, poem on his 63rd birthday. Second stanza, I did not choose to be born in springtime, the briefest season, but I may choose the day I die, if reason dictates such a choice be made. And a day like this one would suffice, which goes back to the saying that we associate with Native American warriors, today is a good day to die. Is that you proclaiming your warrior nature, also proclaiming your rights as a person who says, "Look, I'm going to do a Kevorkian thing if I have to."
The latter. I'm not a warrior, and I find that the sort of the warrior language, warrior culture, really bothers me a lot.
Even the spiritual warrior?
You can't be a spiritual warrior. You can't. Being a warrior is antithetical to spiritualism.
Antithetical.
Yeah.
Why?
Well, because warrior implies aggression. And spiritualism requires acceptance.
You talked about the koan, the sound of one hand.
Yeah.
As opposed to the sound of one hand clapping. And the there was a moment where that student was ready to disembowel himself.
Yeah.
Till he got it. Is that a person? Could that person be seen as a spiritual warrior? Tell me again the name of the man.
No, I was Hakuin. Buddhism has to begin with an idea about not killing. Now, you can't not kill. You have to eat. And for you to eat, something must die. So a lot of people, for instance, say, I don't eat things that have faces. That's their way of dealing with it. That's just, you know, that's not a warrior spirit. It's antithetical, as I was saying. But I would also point out that the monastic life is not something that I've ever experienced or ever wanted to experience. As close as I ever got to that was the U.S. Marine Corps, which is a warrior culture.
Or Kenneth Rexroth's relation, his ability to relate his experience to you.
Yeah.
Well, I'm glad we got this final part down. Sam, thanks for your generosity of spirit.
Pleasure.